But of course you are. And now, of course, clearly, without so much as a by your leave, we simply move directly into the weather forecast for Lincoln, England, from Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar.
So the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 8 degrees centigrade, lows of 5 degrees centigrade, and it's a day of heavy rain and a gentle breeze.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
This week at Lincoln, we had Chris Packham doing a wonderful session with General Lincoln School of Journalism, and of course the PR students were there in force promoting the whole thing, PR communications. And it was all about climate change, and we even had some Extinction Rebellion folk actually on campus. I see, Gabriella, from the latest news from the Gibraltar Chronicle, that over 200 concerned citizens living on the Rock of Gibraltar joined hundreds of thousands of people around the globe to obviously share this concern. And I gather it's unseasonably warm there. Is this so?
Yeah, it's been. Yesterday was the first time I wore a jacket. But we were seeing last week temperatures up to in the 20s, even 26 a couple of weeks ago, which is strange for end of October, beginning of November. Not normal wearing a T-shirt out in the beginning of November. But now it's gone down to about 19, which is still rather warm for this time of the year. So it's been a very strange start of autumn for us because I've never, at least recently, seen it so warm. I haven't remembered wearing a T-shirt in November for the whole first week and walking around like that and being perfectly fine. So it's strange.
The critical question, of course, being how is Frodo coping with this unseasonable warmth?
Yeah, he's been good because for him, he's used to it as long as it's not August heat. August heat is when we have to make sure that he only walks in the shade and he's got plenty of water. But he's used to this weather because this is about our maybe spring kind of weather.
Oh. It's spring and autumn, I suppose.
But still really warm. I remember always having to wear, at least by October, a jumper of some sort.
Exactly. We give hats off to James Ravenio, who apparently was awarded Sea Scout of the Year in 2019. In fact, talk about James Ravenio whilst I go and actually open the studio door to actually allow our birthday girl, Kira Olsbrook, to actually enter the studio. So you just fill for a minute or so, Gabriella. That's okay. We trust you. You know you can do that. The floor is yours.
Okay. So James Ravenio won a prize for Best Sea Scout of the Year, and there's a song going on, so listen to that.
Yes, keep going, Gabriella, we still need you.
Oh, okay, I thought there was a song going on and cutting me off. So as well, Gibraltar has its Gibraltar Literary Festival next week, where we have many authors coming down to the Rock. They'll be visiting places such as the Gibraltar Garrison Library, the university, the convent where the governor lives, and there's going to be talks on so many different subjects, anything from the Barbary macaques. So two doctors did a lovely book detailing the lives of the macaques, and there's also been talks. I interviewed someone last night on the nocturnal mind. So what we do when we're asleep and how we're extremely vulnerable, because the only people who can ever know what we do is not ourselves. We have to be told by others what we do when we sleep. So there's been cases of people sleep driving, you know, getting out of the house, picking up their car and being told by a neighbor that they were driving up and down the high street. There being cases where even a partner told their husband, oh, you've been sleep talking and walking, and then turns out he hadn't. Actually, she'd been gaslighting him. So it was really interesting to find out that while you're asleep, you have no control and it all relies on the person beside you and whether or not they're telling the truth about what you actually do. So think Alex might be coming back.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just super. Yeah. I mean, I was figuring basically we'd scrap.
I think I've just bored everyone. No,
we would scrap the whole sort of sequence, but at the end of the day, I think, you know, you could just go on for a couple of hours. I mean, you're almost going for the Richard Fitzwilliams Award of just open the microphone.
I just went on, yeah. I was talking about the Literary Festival.
Yeah, I know what you were talking about. I was listening for the last 4 minutes. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's all
was it interesting at least?
I thought it was gripping. It was so gripping.
The nocturnal thing just stuck out to me because I did an interview last night, and it was so interesting listening about how people can sleep drive, and then
how do you think you know, they do these programs
by their partners? It's mad. So you can, you know, I sleep a bit strange. I've been known to have my eyes open and talk, but do I actually have my eyes open and talk? I don't know because it relies on the person beside me.
No. I mean, bottom line is you simply get a camera and you actually record yourself. That's all you need to do if you're
really
well.
That is true, but I've never done that.
Yeah, well, there you are, you see. That's what you need to look towards. Would you like to wish Kira Alsbrook happy birthday before she has arrived in the studio?
Yeah, happy birthday, Kira.
Thank you.
How old now?
98.
20. No, I'm actually 18. I'm not doing good for my age.
Yeah. Whatever, you know, it's not the years, it's not the mileage, it's the experience. Speaking as a 146-year-old. Moving on from that sort of perspective, we've talked about James River Avenue, we've talked about the Gibraltar Literary Festival, which is what we wanted to do. We've found out how Frodo is, we've had climate change, we've done so much, Gabrielle. It's just been fantastic. Just feel so we've opened the whole thing through. So, Kira, would you like to put those last two questions to Gabriella, please?
Yes. So, Gabriella, have you had an interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
I have, thank you.
And will you be joining us again next week?
Yeah, I will, during the Literary Festival.
It's very exciting, because that's what it's all about. It's festival, and it's literary, and it's Gabriella as well. It's going to be fantastic. Speak soon. Bye now.
Bye.
I never meant to call you when you sorrow. I never meant to call you when you pain. I don't want to want that night to see laughing. I only want to see you laughing in the purple rain. Seem to make up your mind. I think you better close it.
suppose if it was Purple Rain, there would be another case for Extinction Rebellion to get concerned. Oh, well, never mind. Moving on dexterously to Richard Fitzwilliams. Good morning, Richard. How are we?
Oh, we are very well indeed. A fascinating week for the arts.
Yeah, in more ways than one, although, as you know, I personally believe that back to the days of Howard Carter and the first excavation and the challenges that sort of befitted them, that any country that takes it will have lots of... You shouldn't disturb Egyptian folk when they're at rest, and you shouldn't exhibit their wares. Good news is Kira Olsbrook is in the studio, and it is Kira's birthday today, Richard, so I just wanted to just relay that.
Happy birthday, Kira.
Thank you, Richard. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well indeed. I mean, three films 2 days ago, that was quite something, cramming them all in, and of course, this is a really, really big exhibition, indeed, 160 artists.
Richard, as it's Kira's birthday, I'm going to ask her what she'd like you to start with. Kira, Richard can either talk about the Tutankhamun exhibition, which is one thing, or he can talk about The Irishman, or he can also talk about the latest wonderful movie, The Good Liar. So it's The Good Liar, The Irishman, or Tutankhamun.
I'm actually going to have to be a little bit boring in some people's eyes and go for Tutankhamun.
Oh, there we are, Richard. That's the choice. So away you go.
Well, certainly, I have to say that, I mean, in 1972, it was the year I came over from South Africa, and that was the year of the Tutankhamun exhibition. Has 50 exhibits at the British Museum. You also had some exhibits such as the Gold Mask, which you don't have these days. In fact, the policy of the Egyptians at the moment is not to let things travel which might be too frail, but it's also to tempt you to Egypt when the Grand Egyptian Museum opens next year. Then, well, they've got 5,000 exhibits that were discovered by Howard Carter in the Tomb of the Valley of the Kings and the Tomb of Tutankhamun in 1922. And I mean, you're looking back at 3,500 years. And I mean, this is memorably fabulous. And I have to say that I really loved the show. I saw it in Paris, and well, I mean, the venue was so impersonal in the Versace Gallery. They've done very, very well. I did get lost once rather bad, I have to say, but I mean, it was over 3.5 hours, and quite frankly, this is really worth seeing. It's absolutely beautiful. Yes, they haven't got the Gold Mask, and I would love to see the throne, and I would love to see a whole cornucopia of glories that were in the first and aren't here, but there are a huge number of fabulous objects, and I mean, it's all, of course, synonymous with gold, which is the theme, as it were, of this exhibition, because it was linked with eternal life. I mean, when you died in ancient Egypt and you were a pharaoh, you had to be prepared for a journey in the afterlife.
It was a bit problematic, of course, for all the wives and servants who actually also suddenly found that their lives were cut short as well from that point of view. I always thought that was a bit questionable, but never mind.
Well, if I were one of them, I too would think that was extremely questionable, yeah. Alex. Yes, yes.
just mind.
Yes, true.
Curious enough, we're wrapping up this programme today in about an hour and a half with the UK director of the Chinese National Tourist Office. And as a world traveller, Richard, I'd just like to put the question to you. Can you name a tourist attraction that isn't the Great Wall of China, the Terracotta Army, Beijing's Forbidden City, or a giant panda?
Well, I was going to say, obviously, the Great Wall of China, and I was going to say the Forbidden City. There I was, tourist attraction. No, I can't.
Well, we'll find out why China actually has more UNESCO World Heritage Sites than any other country.
Well, you could be genius and just...
Well, that I didn't know.
You could be genius
this will be
and just
very interesting
interview. That's why I thought I'd put it out to you, a little teaser head, Richard, because, I mean, I know that people wake up to your good self and sometimes, you know, they think, after that, where do we go? Well, Su Ling will be talking about that and, as I say, why China does indeed have more UNESCO World Heritage Sites than any other country. And curiously, only 5% of British people have ever sampled true Chinese food. Well,
That is extraordinary. And there I was entering the exhibition.
Exactly.
All these,
yes, yeah.
That's a fabulous reproduction of wall murals.
Walking
this up. We didn't have in the Paris exhibition,
precisely.
And this, in this sense, and I thought this was absolutely beautiful. Mm. very informative use of film. And I must make one very, very significant point. The labeling is legible. Instead of being on floor level or whatever, they've actually got legible labeling. So thousands of people can read what the exhibits are.
Yeah, but surely you should crouch down. It's part of going to an exhibition.
Yes, I thought you'd be in favour of that. I really did. I mean, that is absolutely horrible.
And use your mobile phone.
From Lisbon to Berlin, museums do it, I have to say. Yeah. And I mean, the first object you view, the exhibited is the exquisitely decorated fan, which shows Tutankhamun hunting ostriches. It was a very warlike age. I mean, there he is with a harpoon.
Sort of big issues with those ostriches. I mean, you know, they're happily sticking their heads in their sand and suddenly they get a spear up their rear end. It's not going to be good.
I can see you're somewhat of a sceptic about Tutankhamun. How about you riding a panther, Alex? How about that? I mean, you know, it's just the sort of thing you might find fun.
It's. I'm not ruling it out. I'm not ruling it in. We'll have to get people to talk to other people and see what happens. Much like Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci do in Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, an epic saga of organized crime in post-war America, told through the eyes of a World War II veteran.
Yes, and what a World War II veteran. Frank Sheeran, played by Robert De Niro. He narrates from his wheelchair in a nursing home. And I mean, one of the extraordinary things is, obviously, that among the groups that make up the American mafia, a melting pot, the mafia, with their Italian origins, have always been one of the most close-knit and notorious. Scorsese has, as we all know, specialized in this topic. And, I mean, he's made an amazingly groundbreaking film. It's quite extraordinary. Firstly, if your age alters, as De Niro's does, owing to the genius of CGI, you could suddenly become young again. You could move back half a century if you wish. It's quite amazing the way this film, the editing, the music, the visuals, all of these contributory
it's,
to
it's what
and, its success. But also what is extraordinary, and I mean, we've seen this before, the mafia codes of behavior, their rituals,
code of silence, you know,
do you paint walls in Lincoln?
Well, I mean, we're assuming we have walls because we like to build bridges in this particular city. I mean, that's what we're all about, the bridge building, as opposed to the painting of the walls and the graffiti. But having said that, there is a wonderful bridge which on one side has, "Do you know where you've been?" And on the other side has, "Where are you going?" I think that's quite philosophical, really.
And each side of the bridge, I mean, if you, say, did paint a wall with someone, or painting a wall involves shooting someone, and the blood, I'm afraid.
Again, questionable ethics. We wouldn't endorse it on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. Yeah,
nonetheless, to get rid of the weapon involved, you'd throw it off the bridge, wouldn't you? There's an absolutely extraordinary scene that, I mean, this is an amazing movie, and quite seriously, it really is fantastic. It just remained with me, and that was, there's an underwater shot of hundreds of guns that have been thrown over a bridge after they've been used by the likes of Sheeran, who is a professional hitman.
When all said and done, it's a movie that surely was made to be viewed on your mobile phone or Netflix device.
You are in a very mischievous mood this morning, Alex. It most certainly was no such thing, but it is, of course, being streamed on Netflix, and this is going to be pretty controversial. What Scorsese's done so superbly, apart from using CGI so well, the music, the editing, the visuals, all of these, they act, so to speak, almost organically on the viewer. They draw you into the murderous and claustrophobic world that the mob inhabits. And also, they're fascinating in the historical parts of it. I mean, the mob's influence on American politics, and also on the Kennedys, especially the Joseph Kennedy, the father of John F. Kennedy. A very, very intriguing appearance by the actor playing him. I will leave it there. Some of the story is told in flashbacks. Sheeran was a van driver, made contact with gangsters, and then starts acting as a hitman. And one of the strengths of this movie also, and be warned, Kira, it's not everyone's cup of tea that they can sit through 3.5 hours, and that is what it is. But the performances of three of this cast are so outstanding that, I mean, I'd say they inhabited the roles. De Niro, Sheeran, he's brilliant as the eponymous hitman. He can be, he's Irish. He can be relied on to kill ruthlessly. And it, what is such a fascinating performance and portrayal. We do see something of his family life, and we do see, long before he actually dies, so to speak, the film goes up to the period where he's suffering from terminal cancer, we see him morally completely dead. And this is after, especially after Ibrahim betrays the Teamsters leader, Jimmy Hoffa. Now, the name Hoffa won't resonate these days, but if you see this film, and certainly there'll be a lot of talk about him, he may need one of those figures whose names one conjured with, as I knew he was the Teamsters leader, and I knew also that he'd vanished. And indeed, he, well, we see in the movie what happened to him.
But reading between the lines, Richard, surely it might be that, you know, one of the characters and protagonists in The Irishman is simply a good liar. Did you see what I did there?
Well, firstly, I mean, you're skipping too quickly.
Okay.
You can't ask me to finish The Irishman without mentioning Al Pacino.
Okay.
As
has he been de-aged as well?
Hoffa, who quite frankly, I mean, he was a person of tremendous power. They did send him down when the Kennedys started to investigate, or to be precise, Robert Kennedy. And he is this is a fascinating study of an egomaniac. Someone who held great power then goes inside, and then when he comes out, he expects to hold the power that he previously had and can't. And what happens is riveting. It's the way this movie's made that's so extraordinary. And there's a character I'd never heard of, or well, I think anybody, or most people, Russell Bufalino, that he's the dominant force behind the mob. And this is Joe Pesci. Who get an Oscar? How these three extraordinary performances, how you get two Oscars out of that, I simply don't know. And really, I mean, you've got other...
Yes, and bear in mind, they're up against Mr. Phoenix and the Joker, which also features...
Phoenix and the Joker,
well.
And also Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and so forth. It really is going to be an extraordinary award season.
Well,
I mean, this is a film, it simply judges most of the time by reenacting events, and there is no more pathetic figure, by the way, than an old dying member of the mafia.
Oh, tell
also,
me about
no one less worthy of pity. I mean, this is large screen stuff. It's made with imagination and flair, and
by
it's
Netflix.
A real. And also being streamed on Netflix in 3 weeks.
So you don't have to see it on a large screen, is what I say.
Definitely do.
If you happen to be a career con artist and finally actually meet up with a well-to-do widow, maybe you can hardly believe your luck. Is this the premise of The Good Liar, or is that a case of, well, it allows Helen Mirren to actually face off against a whole range of things in a Bill Condon developed line, with, of course, Sir Ian McKellen as well?
Well, yes, in the movie, I have to say, I was looking forward to enormously, because you've got two real pros, two absolute favourites of mine, playing off one against the other, an elderly con man, Roy Courtney, who's McKellen, meets a sweet-natured widow, Betty McLeish, played by Helen Mirren, and they hit it off, or appear to, on the first blind date. So, I mean, this may, well, perhaps it'll be like Viagra to Silver Surfers. There's one line in the film that I did laugh at. This is after Roy leaves the date. He tells the taxi, "Take me to Stringfellow's," and what's happening there, he and nefarious types are planning a fraudulent scheme that is going to involve Russians. Now, if you believe this sort of plot, and quite honestly, I mean, it's one of the most fantastic plots I've ever seen, quite literally fantastic. He develops problems walking, you see. He hasn't got a fixed abode, so he can't walk up the steps once he's being dropped off by dear Betty and her grandson. So she says, "Come and live in my home," and it's full of money, and so is she, and he wants to get hold of it. Not only that, but his tax advisor, Vincent, played by Jim Carter, firstly, he moves into her home, and secondly, his tax advisor starts doing or handling her affairs. I mean, of course, this is so absolutely absurd and preposterous. Who is playing what and doing what to whom?
Well, as Kira's just identified, Richard, it's got the butler from Downton Abbey in there. So, I mean, you know.
Yes, and the butler from Downton Abbey was much better staying in Downton Abbey and not involving himself in a plot that I have to say is so complicated. I'm not even going to attempt to go into it. Betty's grandson, Stephen, played by Russell Tovey, he keeps turning up absolutely everywhere they go. Even Berlin is there, and of course, we discover that the loathsome old Roy, this is Ian McKellen enjoying himself, pulling faces and having lots of fun. He must be about playing a character of about 80, and there's no single attribute that is even remotely human in the way he intends to strip her of all her money, rather like, unwisely, he and Vincent try and defraud others in this group scheme which involves Russian gangsters. That might not be as wise as he thinks it is. It's all quite amusing in bits, but this loathsome, cantankerous old swine has got a lot to hide. And if you really start looking at the way the twists and turns of this movie, I mean, there's so many that I started at the end of it.
I sense exasperation, Richard, just a modicum of exasperation coming across.
Well, the thing is, I love McKellen and I love Helen Mirren and also their London settings and all the rest of it. But the trouble is that when we go back in time, and not once but twice, to wartime Germany, no less, and then to Berlin after the war, what's going on? So many things in this movie are going on that, I mean, I started getting very, very irritated because, quite honestly, the person who's really being conned here is the viewer. And, I mean, I only conclude by saying this is inadequate material. Millerman's role is less flamboyant than McKellen. She does it well enough, but I mean, I just simply didn't believe it. A couple of murders don't make a film exciting. They simply stretch it out longer. Right, so when asked whether they were available...
Same can be said about the Joker, of course.
Well, when asked if they were available for this movie, I mean, I think they should have lied and said no.
Well, read between the lines, that's what I say.
Mean, it's just not... It is so, frankly, preposterous. Mm. I met somebody afterwards who was trying to explain the plot to me, and I suppose some of it was explicable or could have happened. Mm. But really...
Take me to Stringfellow's. Peter died a few years ago.
At least there you'd know where you were, whereas with this, I mean, it's simply that they make up so much of it that Bill Condon directs with total lack of panache. I mean, this...
He took the paycheck. He does the business. That's all we need to say, really.
Took the paycheck as well, and so did McKellen. I wish they hadn't.
Oh, dear. At the same time, you know, Peter Stringfellow, I suppose, back in his day, probably the Tutankhamun of London. Maybe not. At least he didn't actually sort of start hunting ostriches, that I'm aware of. Let's test
Goodness
in the studio.
Me. I mean, I can only go back to Tutankhamun, which is something that's superb, and...
Been a good liar, that's all. You know, that's all. He might have had a good PR agency working for him.
Well, you gaze at the mesmerizingly gorgeous wooden hawk with solar disc and the bas statue of the boy king. Then, I mean, come out...
I can't stop thinking about those poor ostriches, frankly, Richard. So
I have to tell, but mind you, I do have to say this, and that is, it's interesting that Tutankhamun's father was Akhenaten, who was the sun worshipped the sun. And subsequent to his rule, he was eliminated, as Tutankhamun was, from history. And it's extraordinary. You see this huge statue at the end of a boy king. Tutankhamun died age 10, not murdered, apparently.
It was an angry ostrich, Richard. It was an angry ostrich. They just haven't actually found that part of the cuneiform and the hieroglyphics to actually sort of see the ostrich.
I think that as penance for all this fun and games, you should go and worship in front of the elaborate gilded wooden statue shrine.
No, sorry, that'd be blasphemy, Richard. So let's move on, and I don't engage in blasphemy, particularly at 33 minutes past 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning. Emma Street, you've heard Richard talk about The Good Liar. You may, en route, have actually heard him talk briefly about the awesomeness of The Irishman. Would you be seeing any of those movies, or indeed would you look to book tickets for this Egyptian exhibition?
The Egyptian exhibition does sound amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to book tickets for that.
It's extraordinary.
I have seen like the trailer and stuff. Is it The Good Liar? Is that what it's called?
The Good Liar.
Yeah, and I thought it looked quite good, but
mind you,
so it does. It looks good. In I mean, yeah. the thought behind it, that you've got a couple playing with their own.
Preposterous, Richard.
That's incidentally obvious.
Totally preposterous.
No, but what is preposterous is the way that, I mean, quite frankly, you sit there, you watch it, you see two first-class performers, it seems to be relatively enjoyable, suspend disbelief to some extent, one or two murders, well, I mean, you know, they happen in London all the time. But just start flashbacks and just start the fact that the character of Betty has the stepson who just keeps, everywhere they go, he suddenly pops up. Why? Could he be looking into the past of this old monster? Well, very probably, but my goodness me, I mean, who on earth wrote this?
And that is the question. But at least, Richard, you can be true to the fact that on your Facebook post earlier in the week, you did indeed say that not only were you reporting on the exhibition for Talk Radio Europe, but our very own Siren Radio as well. So that's nice. That's very good.
No, indeed. And it really is, if you can get tickets.
Well,
it is a
that's
must.
Always apparently, the way.
Apparently, this is supposed to be the last time that Tutankhamun's exhibits, as I mentioned, leave Egypt, and they've got 160. I mean, so...
Richard, free the ostriches. That's all I say. Free the ostriches. Kira, what about yourself? Any of those three suggestions put forward?
I would definitely love to go down to this exhibition. Definitely. It's really... Egyptology? It really interests me a lot, so does any part of history. But as for the films,
yeah.
I'm not really into you.
Neither.
I mean, I'm not an action person.
Mm.
But
apart from Downton
like...
Abbey, of course.
There's loads of action that
action
goes on in there.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, I do like the idea of The Irishman. Just
look
quite good.
And Emma?
What an idea. I mean, if you can use CGI, it's quite extraordinary. Scorsese's made a movie of this sort. I mean, and also pulled it off.
Yeah. Well,
and 3.5 hours will pass without you...
Exactly.
Well, I mean, you know it's a long film, of course. I knew before I went in, but it's just the imagination, it's the zest, and also the way it's held in flashback, the audacity of it.
Quite literally, that boldness. I mean, it's like Emma coming around last night and saying, Joker, meh, you know, not really.
I wasn't a fan of Joker,
but
it just wasn't for me.
So there we are.
Well, The Joker is certainly a film that's made a hell of an impact, and that's made one hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, but that's not everything we need in this world. What about the soul? What about spirit? You know, what about, you know, the election we're faced with? We can't talk about it. We'll leave it there.
No, heaven's sake, don't go into that. I mean, it's impossible. I was watching some of the news
That's what you call the beggaring of belief from that point of view. Definitely, it's not working at all.
Beggars all description. That's from Antony and Cleopatra.
Huh?
That was about Cleopatra's bard, so I'm saying it here.
Yeah, and rightly so. I think Emma's going to put those last two questions to you. Go, Emma.
Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Fascinating.
And will you be joining us again next week?
Indeed I will.
Great.
Didn't think before deciding what to do. All that talk of opportunities, TV breaks and movies rang true, sure rang true. Seems it never rains in summer. Self-respect, I'm out of breath. I'm a
folks back home. I nearly made it at our first, but don't know which one to take. Please don't tell them how you found me. Don't tell them how you found me. Give me a break. Seems it never rains in Southern California.
Something which clearly most people would actually say we have too much of. We have to challenge the issues relating to that, and yet maybe we need it after all. I don't know. With more than a third of UK workers considering quitting their job due to stress, that suggests that actually something is awry. And to talk about some of the findings of some recent research into the challenges of mental health related issues and stress in the workplace, we're very pleased to welcome Chief Executive of Investors in People, the wonderful Paul Devoy. How are you, Paul?
Very well, thank you.
That's good to hear, because I'd hate you to think you're actually stressed at this particular time of day already, but never mind. You know, a certain amount of stress, as we say, kind of we need to keep going, but these findings with 15.4 million days lost to mental health-related issues in 2017-18 and approximately a cost of £99 billion being lost by the UK economy because of poor mental health, these aren't good findings, are they?
No, they're not. They're not good findings at all, but I don't think they're that surprising because they correlate with other research that's already been published.
Well, that's, of course, the key thing, Paul, that, you know, you say not really surprised by the findings that's actually there. I mean, is stress something that actually is having more of an impact when people actually start thinking about stress? They become even more stressed and it becomes a kind of vicious circle, really.
Yeah, I think people are more willing to talk about stress now than they were in the past. So I think it's always been there, but it was more of a hidden problem in the past. But it's now something that people are actively discussing, and therefore employers have to have a response to it.
So in terms of actually looking at the kind of things that we're talking about here, can you give us some examples of how these sort of stresses are manifesting? Is it a case of too much time, too many things to do, too little time to do them in? Is it a case of scheduling? Is it a case of being asked to do too much? Is it a case of fear of failure? I mean, or is it a combination of all of those?
It's a complex puzzle of a number of things. I think the first thing that I would highlight is a conversation I had with a GP couple of years ago, and he said to me that 80% of the people who came into his surgery with mental health problems were work-related. And he said that all he could do was write them a prescription for some sort of medication, but actually what he wanted to do was write them a prescription for a better boss. We've got 2 million accidental managers in the UK, and we don't invest enough in training people to be good managers. And your relationship with your first-line manager is absolutely central to how you feel about your work experience and the level of stress that people are exposed to. So, you know, the first thing is that we need to invest more in training people to be good managers. Just because someone's a great nurse or a great electrician or a great salesperson doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be a good manager.
Well, I think you can actually take it from the sporting world that how many brilliant footballers effectively fail when it comes to managing people because they expect other people to live up to their standards. And maybe is that one of the other aspects where, as you rightly said, you might be somebody who is very good at their job, they're promoted into an admin post or they're put into that post, and then suddenly they're expecting similar standards without necessarily being realistic about their expectations.
Yeah, I think the football one's actually quite a good analogy. Most of the top managers weren't necessarily, you know, brilliant footballers. Sir Alex Ferguson, Jurgen Klopp, they weren't top footballers, but what they were really good is that they were good psychologists and they understood how, you know, the mental condition of people, and they knew how to get the best out of people. And that's just the core skill of a good manager, is being able to work with a diverse range of people and understand how they tick and how to get the best out of them. And that's a skill that, you know, it can be taught, but people have to be invested in to understand how to do it properly.
And certainly the title of your own organisation, Investors in People, suggests that actually people are a resource, as most valuable resource to actually tap into. Is that something that sometimes, in both the public and the private sectors, that people tend to forget that actually it's the team that's actually working with them that are there? Or do you sometimes get a sense that, you know, one of the feelings is that managers are often being perceived by their workforce as though they kind of put up with their workers as some sort of necessary evil?
Yeah, I think every progressive organisation understands that if you treat your people well, then they will treat the organisation well. I think Richard Branson said that, you know, in a quote, that, you know, the whole fear about if you train and treat your people well, then they'll go somewhere else. Well, actually, they won't. If you treat them well and train them well, they'll have loyalty to you, and through reciprocity, they'll want to give that back. It's just part of the human condition. If someone treats you well, then you want to treat them well. So if an employer treats their employees well, you know, provides them with better work and better working conditions, then they will go the extra mile for that business.
So what additional advice would you give, Paul, to employers to actually help this almost epidemic of stress that we seem to be suffering within Britain and indeed probably the Western world for that matter?
Yeah. So the first thing is, don't assume that when you're promoting someone into a managerial position that they're just going to be able to fly into that. It's a very different skill set. So you need to make sure that your managers have the right training and support to look after their people properly. Because if they do that, then the people will perform better. I also think organisations should make a public commitment to how they're going to deliver a healthy workforce and create the conditions where everyone in that workforce can thrive and make that really transparent. And then they need to measure their progress and do that transparently as well. Show their employees that they're measuring how well they're doing and that they've got a commitment to constantly improve the conditions that they create for their workers.
And I suppose there is the question, of course, that with constant metrics and constant quantification, that can also add to the stress that people feel. But presumably we haven't solved that issue as yet.
I think if it's done in a positive way, that there's a commitment across the organisation, both from the employer side and the employee side, that they want to create a working environment where everyone's happy to be there and feel like they're going in a workplace where they're supported to be the best version of themselves every day, then it's a win-win on both sides. It makes the business perform better. All the research shows that's the case. And it makes the lives of the individuals who work for that organisation better too. So I don't see why there's any reason why you wouldn't do it.
OK. So, Paul, where can people go to find out more about Investors in People or indeed these surveys we've been talking about today?
Yeah, if you go into our website, investorsandpeople.com, there's lots of research and information and tips and tools about how you can improve the performance of your organisation there.
Fantastic. And I've got to ask a question, Paul. Were you given training yourself when you became Chief Executive Officer of Investors in People, or did they say, no, it's Paul Devoy, you'll be able to handle it, just drop him in there?
Yeah, well, I started off my career in the civil service, and one of the things the civil service was good at is that before you were allowed to manage a team, you had to go on a two-week training course. So I've always been in environments where I've been given that training up front, and I think I would have. It's, even after you have the training, it's not easy. Managing people is not an easy thing to do, but it certainly helps if you're given the support and the training to give you the best opportunity to do it well.
Indeed so. Paul Devoy, Chief Executive Officer, as we said, of Investors in People. Many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thanks very much.
Managing people is not an easy thing to do. The words of Steve Bruce? Maybe. Ian Lennox, welcome to the programme. How are we?
I'm very well, thank you.
Marvellous. A little bit of an issue with you, Ian. You're a Newcastle United fan, I believe, and also Blyth Spartans, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So why are you actually putting on your Facebook feed a Tottenham Hotspur player?
What's this?
Exactly. I thought that would get you to perk up, Emma. You know, suddenly they come in on the back of a 4-0 victory, etc. We have Ian Lennox saying, good decision, the reaction
scored.
Of...
well, I'm really confused.
Bless no. Kira. That's the... Ian, it's Kira's birthday. Would you like to wish Kira happy birthday from Tyneside Pet?
Is this Kira Knightley?
No, it's Kira Osbrook.
Right on. No, I'm very glad. Many happy returns, Pet.
There we are.
Thank you.
So, many happy returns, Pet. You know.
See, I'm used to the Pet.
Are you?
That's my granddad calls me Pet for some reason. Oh. I don't know why. Oh. Maybe it's just a northern thing in general. I just love the accent.
There you are.
I'm where some young ladies were sort of going towards this rail station, and one girl who obviously came from outside the area had been staying with these people, and she got to the end of the bus stop and she said, well, goodbye, flower, pet flower, love and hinnies.
I like that.
Yeah, pet flower, love and hinnies. So, this Son Heung-min's red card for a tackle on Andre Gomez, you actually would say good decision, the fact that that's been rescinded.
It is a good decision.
I knew you'd say it, Emma, as a matter of fact.
No, I'm not just saying that as a Spurs fan, but there was no way that that was a red card.
Okay. Just VAR. Do you think VAR is ruining the game, Ian, or is it a case of, look, after the Rugby World Cup on Saturday, there's nowhere else for us to go apart from St James Park and look at another ball?
I don't think it's improved the game in the way that people thought it would. There's been so many delays and so many, there's been discussions about the veracity of some of the VAR decisions. But I think I can only hope it'll get better as people use it more, you know, as we use it more, we'll refine it, I suppose. And I hope the authorities start listening to people and their concerns about it. I think it will do. I think they know they're in a transition period.
Well, let's move on to another update, which I'm sure we can actually have both Kira taking one of these lines and Emma taking the other. So, Kira, if you'd like to actually read that little thought bubble there.
Okay, right. I haven't got my glasses, so bear with me.
It's fine.
So, do all fairy tales begin with Once Upon a Time?
And Emma?
No, many of them begin... if I'm elected, I promise.
Yeah, sure, I did that. That is going to be the sole comment as far as politics is concerned on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, so just work our way through that. An interesting line, Ian. Are you looking forward to the shenanigans that have already kicked off now?
No, I'm sick of that. Haven't we? We've had 3 years of
You're dropping out, Ian. You know, you're getting sort of little patchy sort of stuff. That it was all right when he was talking about pets, hinnies, and flowers, etc. But once he even starts sort of talking about the rail, he just drops out in all sorts of ways. Never mind, Ian. Is it raining in Newcastle?
Yes, it's raining everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, but we like that whole thing. Now, it's been quite some time since, obviously, you've had a chance to speak to Emma Street, Tottenham supporter. Would you like to share some discussions with her? I mean, I think the sheer joy that Fergus had last night almost silenced him after, sort of, you know, because he was waiting for weeks to actually sort of say about the result against your side. But no, he's sort of worked all the way through that. But anyway, any questions you'd like to put to Emma, Ian?
Yes, why did he become a Spurs fan?
As opposed to a Manchester City one.
It's a family
follow
thing.
Your father. Follow your father.
You see, my dad's side of the family is Manchester City, but my mum's side is Spurs, and it's, I don't know, I guess it's something that I've always supported since I've been little, really. It's been kind of ingrained in me since I've been born.
Yeah, it's sad when that indoctrination takes through, isn't it?
But I am old enough now to make my own decisions, and I still stand by.
You do.
Following footsteps of my family.
A mid-table side. Oh, well, never mind.
we're doing okay. We've had our troubles, but...
Yeah. Well, troubles. It's very good. Does that answer your question, Ian? Do you feel as though you've completed the thing successfully?
Yes, I think it does. It's always a peculiar thing. There seem to be two sorts of people. Some people who support teams through television, and they grow up, and they may support a team that's 100 miles from where they live. Usually ones because they're successful. And other people who support, backwards co-op third team because they live near there. This is part of their community, and that's it.
Is there genuinely a side called Backworth Cove Third Team?
It could be. I don't know.
I just thought you were creating it from one of your novels.
I'll make a football team out of that. For all I know, I don't know.
And for the last word, clearly, because we need to kick stones for the next few years, the Rugby World Cup final. Your thoughts? Did you sort of think, you know, just at the moment where I thought we were going to have another world champion, a year which saw the 2020 cricket team actually do the business, you thought we'd actually bring back the Webb Ellis Trophy? Was it deep despair that you were faced with, Ian, or is it a case of I give up anymore? There's no point.
No, I think looking at that game, I think we would probably, if we played South Africa 10 times, I think we'd probably win 7. But the first thing we would do would learn by our mistakes, which we'd have to have a scrum that wasn't pushed back, because we gave away, I think, 4 penalties in the first half through that. And we generally didn't play, they played out their skins, they tackled us fiercely and did everything they did at the best of their abilities. And we didn't. We got knocked on the back foot a bit. Some of the players didn't have their best of games. And we made bad mistakes, you know, where we pushed the knock on and the kick off and stuff like that. It cost us points.
Yeah. Well, never mind. You know, it's over now, so we'll just have to sort of, you know, grin, bear it, and maintain that that's what happens when you have an Australian in charge of your team.
Newcastle won 3-2 at West Ham, so it wasn't all that bad.
Yeah, I was wondering whether you'd actually sort of mentioned that, but, you know, you did, and fair enough. That's okay. So
you tried to get me off the air before I could, but I...
Ian, get you off the air, just because as we actually head through the next part of the programme, we're talking about cyber security and the importance of dealing with proper security challenges so that your cybercrime rates don't go high, and also the fact that half of British folk are missing taking their regular prescriptions. 68% of folk are actually forgetting to take their prescription, despite knowing the risks to their health. And prescription medicine actually is costing the NHS £9 billion on an annual basis. So that's to come, plus reasons to visit China. We've also got Richard Bantfield talking about wine. And, I mean, Ian, are you a wine drinker, or is it a case of, no, I don't do wine, I'm a Newcastle Toon Brun man person?
I don't know. Wine's an acquired taste, which I haven't yet acquired, really, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, new research has revealed that UK wine drinkers are quick to judge people who give boozy gifts before giving away those bottles that they think are inferior, with nearly half of British folk admitting to re-gifting a bottle of wine, and nearly a fifth of us having judged someone for the wine that they've brought to an event like a Christmas party or dinner party. I mean, you know, Kira, I'm not sure if you're having a birthday party today, but if somebody comes along with a bottle of wine, you say, oh, I didn't particularly like that. You know,
I will ask where it's from, and if it's from Bargain Booze, I'll throw it back in the thing. No, I'm joking.
If it's not, that's a sad thing.
No, I don't mind. It depends on the wine. Mm-hmm. Depends on the wine.
And any reason why you've actually removed the muffler on your microphone? So actually,
it actually fell off.
Is that so? Right.
It's stress reliever.
Well, yeah, that's not necessarily what they're there for. They're to be put on the microphone. I know. Sometimes I just wonder. Emma, anything you'd like to ask Ian about life, the universe, you know, his thoughts on Tottenham last night and so on? Well, anything, really.
I don't think I want to hear that. Oh, no, we did do very well last night, I think.
4-0.
4-0. We did very well.
The corner has now been turned, according to Maurizio Pochettino.
Well, we beat you 2-1.
Well, that didn't take long, did it? That was...
He perks up like some kind of jack-in-the-box, really. Wow. It's just there, straight away.
That was
amazing.
And we went away at Spurs.
It was a long, long, long time ago. But this season, well, strange things. That's why they have the Egyptology exhibition that's to the fore. Okay, Kira, as you're the birthday girl, would you like to put those last two questions to Ian Lennox, please?
Yes.
It's like Ian. A treat, isn't it, really?
It is. Yeah. Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, I have, especially wishing you a happy birthday.
Thank you. You get extra brownie points now. Would you I forgot the next question. That's it. Will you be joining us again next week?
I do hope so, but I won't wish you a happy birthday next week because it would feel...
Well, you can do it every week, actually. I mean, because one of those will actually get it right, which is marvellous and wonderful. And here's Mahalia featuring Burna Boy. Excellent. That's what we wanted. And the weather today in Lincoln, highs of 8 degrees centigrade, lows of 5 degrees centigrade. It's going to be a day of heavy rain, but with a moderate, I say again, moderate breeze. That's all we needed to know, really. Time for Billy Myers, after which cybercrime, cybersecurity, and more. Just don't sound the same.
miss me. I hear you say you do, but not the way I'm missing you. What's new? How's the weather? Is it stormy where you are? You sound so close, but it feels like you're so far. Oh, would it mean anything if you knew what I'm left imagining? In my mind, would you go? Would you go?
Cybercrime. It's something which isn't from the latest incarnation of Doctor Who or various other aspects. Indeed, it feels more of a threat than physical crime for a rising number of households across England and Wales, according to a recent survey. So to talk about the challenges of cybercrime and how many people, the British public, are becoming more concerned with cyber threats than physical crimes, we're very pleased to welcome the CEO of Neighbourhood Watch. First of all, John Haywood Cripps. How are you, John? Excellent. And we've also got the wonderful officer of the joys of Avast, a security company. That's Pete Turner. How are you, Pete?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. John, if we can come to you first, because clearly a burglary, a home invasion, whatever you call it, that's very, very frightening at the best of times. And yet it seems that people are getting even more stressed about the notion of, obviously, cybercrime, etc. I mean, is it just a case of we're getting our houses more secure, so people are actually going more into cyberspace to actually engage in unfortunate activities?
I think criminals are use what's available to them, and the you being able to use cyber to scam people and trick and con people out of money is becoming an increasing threat. I think about a third of people certainly are very worried about cybercrime, as much or if not more so than burglary now.
Mm. And Pete, is this something that you found from your own sort of work with respect to security, that actually more and more people at least know at least one person who's fallen victim to cybercrime, at least or have heard about it happening to people that they don't know?
Yeah, I think we all know someone who's received an email or fallen victim to a scam, or at least received it in their inbox. It's happening all too often, whether they be data breaches that we hear about in the news or individual things that maybe have affected us or one of our family members or friends. It's becoming very common.
So, John, this partnership between Neighbourhood Watch and Avast, which clearly, as I say, is one of the global leaders in cybersecurity, Cyberhood Watch. Talk to us a little bit about it and why it's going to be such a vital part of, obviously, people's general home security measures.
I think the project with Avast will be successful, and it will create a series of tools and guides that are very simple for ordinary people to be able to ensure that they are safe online. We'll be working with Avast to create Cyberhood Watch ambassadors. So these are local Neighbourhood Watch representatives who will be support people in their communities and also have information sharing events and make information, really simple information, available, including an accredited course and an online program that people can go through to make sure that they are staying safe online.
We hear huge amounts of, obviously, ways in which you can control your heating from applications. You can actually have monitors of your home applications. You don't even actually be to staying at home to actually have a virtual presence there. I mean, is that something, again, Pete, that you're very concerned about, that people don't just hack into those systems and obviously create no end of challenges with respect to how people actually use their devices at home?
Well, I think, yeah, at Avast, it's our job to be concerned about them. And I think people need to know that there are ways they can do to protect themselves. But these devices, of course, are very convenient. They're very useful for us, but also they represent a really good way for hackers or criminals to access our data and our homes, find out information about us, maybe when our house is empty, or even just trying to obtain information that can help them get into our email or our bank accounts and so on. So it has been a problem for a while. I think the more online services that we join up for, the bigger the opportunity there is for the criminals. And we have to remember there are people out there whose day job it is to take our information, and working with Neighbourhood Watch gives us this ability to really, I think, reach out to the local communities to help people help themselves, which is so important.
And John, what advice would you give people who are listening to this and might sort of think, oh no, we can't cope with another challenger, etc. It's just too much stress, we can't cope, and they really want to disengage with the whole cyberculture we're in?
I think we know that being involved online and either shopping, banking, is becoming increasingly popular across all tranches of society. So I think it's quite difficult to step out. The steps that can be taken to keep safe are very simple, about keeping all your software and apps up to date, making sure that you've got that your passwords are complex. I mean, you know, ideally involving three different words, but also making sure that you keep your antivirus software up to date. And if that happens, then you'll be going a long way to ensuring that you stay safe online.
And Pete, would you recommend, for further information, people should actually immediately move to avast.com?
Yeah, I think there's a number of free solutions to help people stay safe, Avast, AVG as well. But equally, I think it's important that they communicate when they hear about things or see things, and I think that's the benefit of Neighbourhood Watch. So make sure you've got your software up to date, and if you find something that you think is wrong, you know, an email with a link in that it looks a bit dodgy, then you let people know.
And Cyberhood Watch, obviously, is with us and will be rolling out. And John, presumably, again, same sort of question. And Neighbourhood Watch, Cyberhood Watch, those are the kind of areas you need to just access and find out what's happening in people's localities.
That's right, absolutely.
John Hayward-Cripps, CEO of Neighbourhood Watch, and CEO of Avast, Pete Turner, many thanks indeed. Have a splendid day and stay cyber safe, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. The clouds reveals blue sky.
Madness, the sun and the rain, and maybe a little bit of nutty behaviour is very good. Perhaps we should learn from our five-year-olds. At least that's the essence of a recent survey that's been conducted, which suggests actually the key to good health, good wealth, good happiness is the kind of daily routines that we look at on the light side of life, such as smiling, laughing, and being silly. This is all down to Seven Seas Cod Liver Oil, and we have two fabulous folk in the studio to actually, well, actually, I'm in the studio, they're in another studio, but they're joining us now to comment on this. First of all, the awesome individual who is Alistair Bryce Clegg. How are you, Alistair?
I'm very well, good morning.
Wonderful. We've also got Dr. James Brown, who obviously, because of the very name, James, you'll feel good. Ow! Sorry, I couldn't resist that.
I do feel good, and yes, my father has a new bag.
There you are. So, sorted out on that. Alistair, talk us through this particular research in terms of this particular campaign, which suggests that our more chronologically gifted folk could learn a great deal from the five-year-olds amongst us.
Well, it's a new piece of research that's been done by Seven Seas Cod Liver Oil, and it just basically talks about routines that adults think are important and routines that children think are important. And, of course, the adults have gone for the really boring stuff like getting a good night's sleep, which is important, drinking water, eating a balanced diet. And children have gone for the things like smiling, laughing, playing with your friends, having a good run around outside and being silly. And I think the point of the research is to say that, yes, all of the things that the adults said are really important, and we want our children to have all of those routines. But also, we know for your kind of physical and mental well-being, that idea of having a bit of joy in your day, however that joy may come, actually lifts your spirits, lifts your self-esteem, and is really beneficial. So it's about adults just trying to bring a little bit more joy into their daily routine and having the benefits of that.
Well, we've got two fine adults in the studio. Actually, they're students, but what the heck. We've actually got Emma and Kira. I mean, Emma, listening to this research, I mean, do you still keep happy? Or is it a case of, I can't be happy, I'm a second-year student reading public relations at the University of Lincoln?
I can certainly understand why, you know, adults find it hard. I think my dad's one of those parents that kind of grumbles about, you know, when you're older, you know, you have time for things you enjoy, you know, it's not going to be fun anymore, and all of those sort of things. Yeah. But I do find that things like seeing your friends and having a little bit of a social life is really important, because the lift that you get mentally from seeing your friends is really important to me.
Is that something you'd echo, James? I mean, from your own perspective, in terms of how you're saying this rollout, that actually it's not just, shall we say, for as a gerontologist and so on, and as a person who specialises in the ageing game, it's more than that.
It is, and I'm going to disagree with Alistair here. I think the things, the behaviours, the habits that the older adults reported they do are actually not boring. They're incredibly important. I mean, getting a good night's sleep, everybody would agree, is valuable. Making sure you drink enough and eat the right balanced diet. They may sound boring, but actually these are the core behaviours we all need to adopt. But when you look at the things that the five-year-olds reported, actually all of these things are incredibly useful for older adults as well. We know that older adults that have a broad social network, so therefore they do effectively play with their friends. We know that older adults that are happier and more positive, that have a positive outlook on life, actually generally tend to be less ill and generally tend to live longer. So if, as older adults, we could adopt some of these slightly silly sounding ideas like running around, playing with friends and smiling, it can actually have a benefit for your health.
And Kira, thoughts from yourself? I mean, do you run around now? You're actually celebrating another year on the planet.
Yes. No, I do believe definitely in what adults and parents say, but I think I'm more strongly I strongly agree more towards what children believe, like with smiling and bubbly. Maybe it's just because who I am, I don't know. But
and a Disney fan as well.
Yeah.
How many hours till Frozen 2 gets released?
Amazing.
Yeah, we'll let Kira get on with that, gentlemen, whilst I actually saw it. So in terms of the whole thing, what's the best? I mean, is it a case of you need a balance? I mean, is that ultimately what we're looking for here in terms of ensuring that, you know, the quality of life is maintained, Alistair?
Yeah, obviously. It is a balance between the more practical habits of every day. I'm not going to call them boring anymore, thanks, James. The more practical habits, and also the ones that bring you a bit of joy. And I just think sometimes when you become an adult, not even just an older adult, an adult, you've got so much more responsibility that your life can get a little more consumed with the practicalities of day-to-day life, and it's easy to lose the time to meet with friends. It's easy to lose the time to invest in a little bit of self-care, and actually it's important to keep that on our radar. But yes, obviously, in as with everything, balance is what we're looking for.
Well, that basically is it. And where can we go to find out further details about this Seven Seas Cod Liver Oil Daily Doses campaign?
You can find more information, because we've actually just really, you know, dipped our toes into this research. You can find more information on the Seven Seas website,
which is relatively straightforward and easy to go to. It's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Alistair Bryce Clegg, of course, known to the whole world as being the person behind Channel 4's Old People's Home for 4-year-olds. I mean, it's just classic. It's what it's there for. And, of course, the fantastic James Brown, not the other James Brown, but certainly connecting on that basis. Gerontologist, which, of course, is a specialist in the whole aging process. Is that correct? Is that best way in terms of gerontology?
Yeah, so gerontology is more about the health of older adults, but I'm also a biogerontologist, which is more about what happens across the lifespan.
That gets even better. Alistair and James, many thanks. And I'm sure we'll speak again very soon. Keep smiling.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Is that the case? Will your year be year when you're given a bottle of wine which might be regifted and so on? Well, the only person we can really talk to address this, particularly in the run-up to the festive season, is, of course, independent master of wine, the awesome Richard Bamfield. How are you, Richard?
Morning, Alex. I'm fine. And you?
I'm okay. Actually, I'm going to juggle with a number of sort of requests from another radio station. This is all very good. And I think, oh, I need a bottle of wine after this. But what the hey? This whole thing about not judging a bottle by its cover, though, of course, is quite critical. Because, I mean, Kira in the studio here has already said that if somebody actually comes along to our birthday party today with a substandard bottle of wine, it's going to be immediately returned.
No, don't say that.
How do you know it's substandard?
Yeah, there we are, Kira. How do you know? How do we know, Richard? You're the master of wine. You know, one of only 389 masters of wine in the entire world.
Oh, well done. Good research.
How do you know? It is. I mean, I think the wine sometimes make wine a bit more complicated than it needs to be. Maybe I'm lucky, but I like most wines. Whatever the price, I'm interested in trying wines, and I just like trying all of them. But look, I do understand that certain people, they do have certain tastes. They might know they like Sauvignon Blanc, or know they like Shiraz, and if that's not what they're given, then they might well re-gift it, and that's fair enough. But I think to think that because it's not what you're used to means it's lower quality, that doesn't seem logical to me. And it's very difficult to tell the quality of a wine just from the cover, from the label.
It's
a bit more complex than that.
Yeah, I mean, Emma, I'm not sure in the street household in terms of what happens with respect to wine, etc. Is it a case of you look at the bottle and think, that can't be very good there?
Well, I'm not a wine drinker at all. So if I get gifted a bottle of wine, then I don't drink it, so I'm straight away thinking about if there's anybody in my family who'd want it or someone I can give it to. But, you know, it's not because I don't think it's up to scratch or anything. It's just, personally, I don't like wine. And I think that's sometimes a problem when you gift something like that.
I'm intrigued, Richard, by this nationwide wine tasting in the dark experience that you're putting together. Can you share with us with respect to that and how? I mean, is it a case of, are people blindfolded? Do they actually just go into a dark room with infrared spectacles?
Oh, no. This is much more profound and dark than that. This is partly to address what we're talking about. That it is difficult to. I make light of it, but it is difficult to know what quality is in wine. There's no question. And the idea of this is that we take away the usual cues. We take away the design of the bottle. We take away the price. We take away the shape of the bottle. And this will be totally in the dark. So it is a very blind environment. No blindfolds, because the room will be dark.
Mm.
And once you take away all those cues, we will then give people some sparkling wines, some red wines, and they will have a chance to taste them, evaluate them, and then we'll be asking them various questions. What might you pay for these? Which one do you think is best? And I think what we hope is that people will come out of it, one, with a bit more confidence in their own ability to assess the quality of a wine, and realizing that very often there is no right and wrong. There's what you like. And then I also think they'll be surprised to find that actually you can get pretty good wines at not too expensive prices. Oh.
And the Lidl, of course, one of those sources that you can go to as well. Presumably, would you recommend Lidl?
Surprise, surprise.
I know, Lidl.co.uk as the go-to site of people sort of saying, yeah, let's find about Lidl prices for little bottles of wine. No, whatever.
That's absolutely right. You can find out then what we're doing for Christmas, what we're recommending there as well. So, yes, that has all the information.
Well, it certainly spills up a whole range of things. Richard, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with you this morning. Have you got a bottle of wine actually there? I mean, is it going to help you through these series of interviews, et cetera? Just to say, I just need a little waft of key things.
I'm sad to say that my colleagues didn't think of that.
No, unbelievable.
No bottle of wine here, but that's probably, probably reassured by that, I suspect.
And I was so sort of, you know, impressed with the engineering staff as well from so often, so I thought they'd be there. But no, actually, on the other hand, you've got that flip side. I mean, as the day proceeds. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning, Richard? Has it been okay for you?
Oh, absolutely great. Thank
Marvellous.
You.
It's our feedback scenario. Can we then prevail upon you to actually join us again? Will you come back in the near future?
I'd be absolutely delighted. And then I'll make sure I've got something beside me to talk about. And maybe we should make sure that you have the same wine as well. Or maybe we'll have to find something that Emma would like to.
And Kira will get it all sorted through,
no
doubt.
Next time we should have a glass of wine in unison. You know,
do you really think so?
Same time as Richard. Yeah.
We are raising our metaphorical glasses of wine to you, Richard, at this very moment in salute, sir. Salut and slangivar.
Just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done, sleeping on the job. Are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's one thing I know, the blues they send
rush up to greet me. Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me.
And it won't as long as you remember to take your prescription. Half of the UK admit that they regularly miss taking crucial medicine, even though it could clearly seriously affect their health. And it all seems to be down to forgetfulness. Well, to address this and talk a little bit more about the importance of ensuring that if you've got a prescription, make sure that you take it and work through the whole process, we're delighted to welcome pharmacist and indeed founder of Echo on prescription avoidance. That's the wonderful Alistair Murray. How are you, Alistair?
Morning, Alex. Very well, thanks. How are you?
Excellent. Of course, you're chief pharmacist at Echo and honorary pharmacy lecturer at UCL. I know human beings are human beings and so on, but I mean, this research shows a staggering amount of people are forgetting to take their prescriptions. You know, is it just a case of, oh, I'm getting a bit better now, I don't need to bother, basically, or they literally just forget?
There are lots and lots of different reasons. Sometimes with that idea of thinking, well, I don't need to take something forever and ever, you know, things like having high blood pressure or high cholesterol, you don't necessarily have symptoms. So people maybe forget that they might need to take something in terms of an outcome. But simple forgetfulness is very much one of the issues. That's something we call unintentional non-adherence.
And certainly the cost alone, I mean, we're not talking about sort of thousands, we're talking millions, if not billions of pounds. I mean, £9 billion in effectively what the NHS are actually being, having to deal with on a loss on a yearly basis. I mean, that's not good by anybody's reckoning.
Not in any way. I mean, the budget for the NHS is obviously enormous, but you're certainly looking at hundreds of millions in terms of the actual wasted medicines. But then when we look at the knock-on impacts on the wider health service and people needing to go for unscheduled appointments and all of this sort of thing to get hold of their medicines last minute, or if they haven't been taking their medicines, needing to go for treatment for complications, the costs soon mount up. And, you know, the costs of the NHS are one thing, but more importantly, that's people's health. It's their lives.
We've got two fine folk in the studio. Kira, any thoughts on this particular story? I mean, have you ever always taken your medicine yourself from that point of view?
Well, I don't actually have anything on prescription at the moment, but I know that my mum in particular, she was on quite a lot of medication, and I think part of it wasn't to do with forgetfulness, it was more to do with how many she had to take, so she forgot which days were for what and what times and everything. So I think it is really important, especially because it's costing the NHS billions. Mm. So something needs to be done about it.
So, I mean, is that a kind of common line, Alistair, that it's not necessarily through willful forgetfulness, if such a thing exists, but it's just a case of slight confusion in terms of what's being taken when and where?
Oh, absolutely. People can end up taking very complicated combinations of things and needing to take some things on some days, other things on other days. Some medicines might be once a day, some medicines might be twice a day. You might need to think about whether or not you're taking it with food, all sorts of different things. And frankly, when you first get diagnosed with something, or depending on what the illness is, you've got a lot of other stuff going on potentially. So it's a lot of new information and a lot of new behaviour to try and incorporate into your normal daily routine.
Emma, any thoughts from yourself?
I am guilty of missing out on some either prescription and... my forgetfulness is that I don't, I don't replace it quick enough, so I don't put my repeat in. So there'll be a couple of days where I don't have the prescription that the medication that I really need, because I lost track of the days, you know, I wasn't organised enough.
It's convenient as well, isn't it, to getting down to the
pharmacy. Yeah,
exactly. Or you can get them delivered to your door now.
Yeah.
But I don't trust that.
No, I like to go and pick it up myself, but I'm really bad at making sure I put my repeat prescription in on time to make sure that I have it before it runs out. So that's something that I need to improve on.
I mean, one of the things that when we were designing Echo in the first place was we wanted to make sure that there was a kind of good timely reminder on when you should place your reorder so that it, A, makes it easy and stops it being a whole load of admin. But also, if there's anything where maybe the doctor wants to have a quick chat and check how things are going, there's enough time to sort that out and still not run out of the medicines to make sure that people have got that continuity.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I think there have been many times where I've got a letter from a doctor, but it's been quite late, saying that they want to have a checkup to make sure that everything, you know, my blood pressure is all right because of the medication I'm on. And then you have the faff, the admin of trying to book the appointment and getting your prescription. So it can all be a bit much, I guess. I can understand why some people would maybe rather not go through all of that.
Yeah, I mean it's something that we see all the time. I've been involved with pharmacy for nearly 25 years, and I take a daily medication. And the number of times that I would forget that if it weren't for the reminders that I'm getting is appalling, given my professional background.
It's part of being human. Where can people actually go to find out further information, Alistair, about how we can actually go through this process and, again, you know, learn about really ordering what we really need and following those prescription issues?
Yeah, so people can go to echo.co.uk. You can also go into local branches of Lloyd's Pharmacy as well. And it's a very important thing, is that we do want people just ordering the medicines that they actually need, because that way people aren't taking unnecessary things, and it's much better for the NHS in terms of avoiding waste.
Which is a win-win situation. Alistair Murray, honorary pharmacy lecturer, I'm sure the honorary will be done away, is it? The pharmacy lecturer at UCL, of course, chief pharmacist and founder of Echo. Echo, does it stand for anything? Is it an acronym?
No, it was, the idea is that it's a repeat. So
of course.
With repeat prescriptions, it's the same message.
Yeah, I like
the communication passing between patients and GPs and pharmacists. We like the idea of that.
There we are, Alistair. You've got two fine communications and PR relations students there,
like
sort of
impressed
with that. So well said, sir. Marvellous.
Marvellous. Well, good luck with your degrees.
Thank you very much.
Heading home.
good news about the sun and the rain. You get rainbows. Hooray! Something is thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Paul Devo, and, of course, Alistair Bryce Clegg, and James Brown, and Richard Bamfield, and Alistair Murray. Still to come, though, it's Mrs. Sue Ling, who's going to be talking about that story we launched with Richard Fitzwilliams earlier in the morning, of course, regarding China and what's happening in China and why we should go and visit China and all the good things about China and all the visions of China. Sylvian's doing now. Possibly this is the Siren Radio. Upcoming programmes, well, not only do we have the Stone Tapes live as recorded at the great Sci-Fi Weekend event in Great Yarmouth at 7 o'clock, we've also got Alex Waterloo's coming up between 11 and 12 with rock music, etc. Molly is around between 12 and 2, and then the Siren News, of course, appearing during the rest of the day, as well as Being Human between 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. Our China connection will be manifesting. We have every faith, don't we, Emma?
That's, we do, yeah. Exactly. Got to keep positive.
It's the only way forward, and run around, effectively.
And smile. And be silly and laugh.
These are the kind of things that make us human, ultimately. questions. Can we name a Chinese animal that isn't a giant panda? Did we know that China is a land of elephants and leopards, as well as golden snub-nosed monkeys, palace cats, sables, and dugongs? We'll have to wait until another time, another show. You know, we dial a number, it's engaged, it's the way forward. We've got other things to do, other fish to fry, to be quite literally the case. Emma, thank you for joining us today. Are you back with us next week?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I might be dropping in on Wednesday as well. Who knows?
Am I? You know, it might surprise you.
Very, all very good from that point of view. Kira, have a splendid birthday for the rest of the day. I'm sure it will work well. That's pretty much it. As we mentioned, great things happening as far as Siren Radio is actually concerned. So stay with 107.3 FM and indeed Siren Radio online. That's it. What should we just say? I suppose it's got to be a happy birthday, Kira.
It
has
to be.
It really has to be, really.
It so, be you know. Else.
So, no, no.
It
okay. So, a 1, 2, 3. Happy birthday, Kira.
Yeah.